There is, there's a voice in your head right now.
There definitely is.
And it is talking about you. Not to you,
yeah.
But like about you.
Right.
Right this very second, it's probably stitching together your memories, you know, making a mental list of what you need to do tomorrow.
Or replaying an incredibly awkward conversation you had in a coffee shop back in 2019.
Oh, constantly.
I mean,
it is constantly, quietly working in the background to build and maintain this feeling that there is a stable, consistent you sitting right there behind your eyes.
Yeah, that running narrative.
Exactly. But today on The Deep Dive, we are asking a very specific question that, honestly, it kind of borders on science fiction.
It really does.
We want to know what happens when a single molecule turns that narrator off.
That's the million-dollar question.
Welcome to today's Deep Dive, everyone. We are looking at a profoundly detailed, just massive article from the OOTW Journal. It's titled, Psilocybin and the Default Mode Network, the Neuroscience of Ego Dissolution.
And what's fascinating here is that we aren't just talking about abstract philosophy today.
Right, no vague ideas about consciousness or, you know, just talking about vibes.
No, not at all. We are going to explore the precise neurological mechanics of psilocybin. The source material allows us to trace exactly how this compound physically alters the brain.
Literally rewiring things.
Yes, how it leads to the literal disintegration of the brain's so-called ego center. And then, of course, we will look at the striking clinical trial results for depression that emerged in 2025 and 2026.
Which is just huge news.
It is. We have this rare opportunity to trace a clean scientific line from one single receptor in the human brain all the way up to the structural integrity of consciousness itself.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we are diving deep into some highly complex neuroscience here. But our goal, as always, is to make sense of this without getting bogged down in impenetrable jargon.
Right, we want to keep it accessible.
We want you, the listener, to get a front row seat to the cutting edge of consciousness research. We have the fMRI data, we have the cellular biology, and, you know, we have the subjective experiences of the actual patients in these massive trials.
It's a very complete picture.
It is. But to really grasp what is happening here, we have to start long before anyone was putting psychedelics into an MRI machine.
Oh, way back.
Yeah. We need to start with the accidental discovery of that inner narrator we mentioned.
Because science is it's often driven by accidents, and the discovery of this neural network is a perfect example of that.
How so?
Well, you have to go back to the early days of functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI.
Right.
Researchers were incredibly excited about this new tool because, for the first time, it allowed them to watch blood flow in the brain in real time.
Which serves as a proxy for neural activity, right?
Yeah.
Like, more blood means more activity.
Exactly. But they ran into a fundamental problem pretty quickly. They needed a baseline.
Because if you want to know what the brain looks like when it's, I don't know, solving a complex math equation or looking at a photograph of a face,
you first need to know what it looks like when it is doing absolutely nothing.
You need a control state.
Precisely. So neuroscientists would put these subjects into these loud, cramped MRI scanners and give them a very simple instruction.
It's just rest.
Yeah, just rest. Don't think about a specific task. Don't try to solve any problems.
Which is hard to do in a loud tube.
Extremely hard. But the instruction was just, you know, stare at a small crosshair on a screen, let your mind wander, and do nothing.
And what do they expect would happen?
Well, the logical assumption among the scientific community was that brain activity would drop across the board.
Like going to sleep.
Sort of. They assumed the brain's energy consumption would just plummet, much like a car engine dropping down to an idle when you take your foot off the gas.
But the data showed the exact opposite, didn't it?
The complete opposite, yeah.
I read that part of the article and it reminded me of, you know, when you close all the apps on your smartphone because your battery is dying.
Oh, yeah.
Only to realize that there is a massive hidden background operating system that instantly boots up the second you stop using the phone.
And it starts draining the battery even faster. That is a great analogy.
Because as soon as these subjects stop focusing on the outside world, this very specific interconnected web of brain regions just completely lit up.
It was a huge shock to the field. I mean, this network became highly active the moment the brain was supposedly at rest.
Supposedly.
Right. And then, and this is crucial, it quieted down the second the person was given an external task to focus on again.
So it's like a seesaw.
Exactly. Because this seemed to be the state the brain reverted to whenever it wasn't externally engaged. Researchers named it the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN. Okay, so anatomically, we are talking about a very specific set of regions that are wired together.
Yes. Okay? Let's map that out for the listener.
Yeah. Where exactly is this background operating system located in the head?
The principal players are mostly located along the midline of the brain. So think of the deep valley that separates the left and right hemispheres.
Okay, right down the middle.
Right. You have the medial prefrontal cortex, which sits right behind your forehead. Then, deeper and further back, you have the posterior cingulate cortex, along with a neighboring region called the precuneus.
The precuneus, okay.
And finally, bridging out to the sides, you have regions called the angular gyri.
So they're kind of spread out but connected?
Exactly. These regions are anatomically distinct, but they fire together in a highly synchronized way.
I really want to dig into what this network is actually doing, because the word resting is incredibly deceptive here.
Oh, completely deceptive.
The ORTW journal piece points out that the DMN is doing heavy lifting. It is handling the machinery of your inner life.
It really is.
Like when we say it handles autobiographical memory, we aren't just talking about remembering facts, like the capital of France.
Oh, no. That distinction is vital.
It's more personal than that.
It is the difference between semantic memory, knowing facts, and episodic memory, which is the subjective feeling of remembering yourself experiencing something.
Remembering what it felt like to be there.
Exactly. The DMN is actively constructing your personal timeline. Furthermore, it handles mental time travel into the future.
Mental time travel? I love that term.
It's what we do all day. When you imagine what you are going to say in a meeting tomorrow or worry about a trip next month, you are using the DMN to simulate a future reality with you at the center of it.
And it also governs something the source calls theory of mind, right?
Yes.
So if I am trying to figure out what someone else is feeling or, you know, anticipating how they might react to bad news.
Your DMN is running a simulation of their mind.
It just seems like everything this network does requires a concept of the self as a reference point.
Which perfectly explains why it is the most metabolically expensive network in the resting brain.
It takes a lot of calories to keep the ego running.
It does. Maintaining a coherent sense of self takes a massive amount of energy.
The source actually describes the DMN's role in the brain's overall hierarchy as that of an orchestra conductor, which I thought was a really helpful way to visualize it.
Yeah, it is. Because the brain is filled with lower level systems, right?
Yeah.
You have the visual cortex processing light, the motor cortex planning movement, the amygdala flagging threats.
All these separate instruments playing at once.
Right. And the DMN is a high level hub that constrains and coordinates these lower systems. It imposes order.
It tells them when to play and when to be quiet.
Exactly. It keeps all the disparate parts of the brain playing the same sheet of music, ensuring that your conscious experience feels unified.
That conductor metaphor is powerful, but it brings up a big question. And I kind of want to push back on a phrase that gets thrown around a lot in popular science headlines.
Sure, let's hear it.
The article mentions that some researchers refer to the default mode network as the neural correlate of the human ego. Mm-hmm. Is that actually accurate?
Well,
because it sounds incredibly reductionist to point to a few glowing spots on an MRI scan and say, look, we found the human ego.
You are hitting on a major debate within neuroscience, and the article is very careful to contextualize this.
Yeah.
The idea that DMN equals ego is a hypothesis. It's not an established mathematical fact.
Right.
The concept of the self is almost certainly more distributed across the brain than just this one single network. The brain is vastly too complex for us to localize something as profound as consciousness to a few cubic centimeters of tissue.
So it's more of a useful shorthand than a literal biological truth.
Exactly that. It is a highly useful metaphor because it perfectly captures why altering this specific network has such a profound destabilizing impact on a person's subjective sense of who they are.
Because it's the conductor.
Right. The DMN maintains the running narrative of me. It is the system that tells you that you are the same person today that you were yesterday.
So if a chemical agent fundamentally disrupts the functioning of the DMN,
then that subjective sense of me is inevitably going to alter with it.
Which takes us to the chemical agent itself. We have established this heavily guarded ego network, this locked door. Let's talk about the master key that opens it.
Psilocybin.
Right. The source material focuses on psilocybin, the molecule found in over 200 species of fungi. But right out of the gate, there is a fascinating chemical twist here.
There is.
Because the psilocybin molecule itself doesn't actually do anything to your brain.
It is a very common misconception. Psilocybin is what pharmacologists call a prodrug.
A prodrug, meaning what exactly?
Meaning when you ingest it, it is biologically inactive. It literally cannot bind to the receptors in your brain in any meaningful way.
Wow.
However, once it enters your digestive system and hits your liver, your body's metabolism acts on it. Specifically, enzymes rapidly strip off a phosphate group from the psilocybin molecule.
It's like the body is actively unpacking the molecule to get to the payload inside.
That is a great way to visualize it. Once that phosphate group is cleaved off, you are left with a new molecule called psilocin.
Psilocin.
Yes, and psilocin is the actual active agent. It is highly lipid soluble, meaning it can easily cross the blood-brain barrier. Psilocin is the molecule that actually does the work.
And the specific lock that this psilocin key fits into is fascinating. It's the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
The 5-HT2A, yes.
Now, the brain is an absolute soup of chemicals, neurotransmitters, and millions of receptors. Why does this one specific receptor matter so much?
The OTW Journal stresses that the 5-HT2A receptor is not just a minor, trivial detail in the brain's architecture.
Okay.
It is the definitive switch for the psychedelic experience. And mm-hmm. to understand why, you have to look at where these receptors are located.
They aren't just everywhere.
No, they are not randomly scattered across the brain. They are densely packed on a very specific type of brain cell called large pyramidal neurons.
Pyramidal neurons. The article mentions they are located deep in layer V of the cortex. What makes these cells so special?
Think of the cortex as having different layers, like the layers of a cake, and each layer has different responsibilities.
Okay, I'm picturing a cake.
Layer V is critical because these large pyramidal neurons act as the major output cells of the cortex.
Output cell.
Right. They send long axons out to connect with other distinct cortical areas and even subcortical structures. They are the broadcasters of the brain. They dictate how entire brain regions communicate with one another.
So if you stimulate these specific cells, you aren't just changing a local neighborhood in the brain.
No.
You are fundamentally altering the long-distance communication lines.
Precisely. When psilocin binds to these 5-HT2A receptors, it depolarizes these pyramidal neurons, making them far more likely to fire.
It hypes them up.
It does. It changes the firing patterns of the brain's primary communication hubs.
Well, wait, let me play the skeptic here for a second.
Go for it.
As I said, the brain is bathed in different chemicals. Psilocin probably binds to other serotonin receptors too, right?
It does have affinity for others, yes.
So how do neuroscientists know, for an absolute fact, that it is just this one specific receptor family, the 5-HT2A, doing all the heavy lifting?
That is the crucial question, and it brings us to a brilliant piece of experimental design highlighted in the text. It's known as the Ketanzarin Blockade Study.
I found this part so elegant when I was reading it. How did they isolate the variable?
Well, ketanzarin is a pharmaceutical drug that acts as a highly selective antagonist, a blocker, specifically for the 5-HT2A receptor.
Okay.
It has a very high affinity for that receptor, meaning it binds to it tightly, but it doesn't activate it.
So it just blocks the keyhole.
Exactly. It just sits there, occupying the lock so that no other key can get in.
So in this experiment, they took a group of human volunteers and gave them ketanzarin first, effectively locking up all the 5-HT2A receptors in their brains.
Right.
And then they gave them a full active dose of psilocybin.
Yes, under strict, double-blind, placebo-controlled conditions. The researchers wanted to see what happens when the psilocin enters the brain but cannot access its primary target.
And what was the result?
The result was profound. The psychedelic experience was almost entirely abolished.
Entirely abolished, meaning they didn't hallucinate, they didn't feel a shift in consciousness, no mystical experiences.
Nothing. The subjects essentially felt nothing more than perhaps a mild, ambiguous physical sensation.
Wow.
The profound shifts in perception, the intense visual geometry, the emotional breakthroughs, the dissolution of the ego, all of it vanished.
Just from blocking that one door.
Block that one single receptor family, and you block the entire cascade.
This is huge for you, the listener,
yeah,
to internalize. Because culturally, we talk about the psychedelic experience as this deeply mystical, ineffable, almost magical journey.
And subjectively, it is.
Right. From a subjective standpoint, for the person experiencing it, it absolutely is magic. But this ketanzarin experiment proves that this profound, world-altering state of consciousness is mechanistically tractable.
It's biology.
It isn't magic. We can trace it back to a physical, biological doorway.
And that biological doorway is what allows us to study the downstream effects. If we know that psilocin turns the 5-HT2A key, We can put someone in an fMRI scanner, give them the drug, and watch what happens to the whole system.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because when researchers finally got the chance to look at a human brain on psilocybin inside an MRI machine, the results completely defied their expectations.
They were stunned.
We are talking about Robin Carhart-Harris's landmark 2012 study at Imperial College London. Let's set the stage for what they actually expected to find.
The hypothesis going into that 2012 study was completely logical based on the subjective effects of the drug.
Right.
If you ask anyone who has taken a classic psychedelic to describe the experience, they will talk about a massive expansion of consciousness.
Everything is dialed up to 11.
Exactly. A flood of vivid visual imagery, rapid streams of complex thoughts, repressed memories coming to the surface, and intense, overwhelming emotions.
So naturally, you would assume the brain is going into overdrive. You would expect the fMRI scans to light up like a Christmas tree.
You would. The researchers predicted that they would see a significant increase in cerebral blood flow, and specifically an increase in the BOLD signal.
Remind us what the BOLD signal is.
BOLD stands for blood oxygen level dependent signal. When a brain region works harder, it needs more oxygen, so blood flow increases to that area.
Okay.
The fMRI detects that change. They expected the BOLD signal to spike across the cortex.
But the BOLD signal didn't spike. It dropped.
It didn't just drop slightly either. There were massive pronounced decreases in blood flow.
Yeah.
Psilocybin profoundly reduced neural activity in key areas, and it wasn't random. The most significant decreases were heavily concentrated in the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex.
Wait, those are the absolute core hubs of the default mode network.
Exactly.
The brain didn't light up. The self network essentially went dark.
The conductor was put to sleep.
That is wild.
But the researchers realized it wasn't just a matter of the overall volume being turned down. The structural integrity of the network itself fundamentally changed.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
This introduces the concept of network disintegration.
Let's break down disintegration in this context, because normally these regions are highly synchronized, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Under normal waking conditions, the MPFC in the front of your brain and the PCC in the back of your brain are tightly coupled.
Like they're talking to each other constantly.
Imagine two pendulum clocks swinging in perfect unison. They fire together. They oscillate together. They are constantly exchanging information to maintain that cohesive narrative of the self.
Right.
But under the influence of psilocin, they decouple.
The pendulum clocks lose their synchronization.
They stop firing together. The network loses its internal cohesion. The biological structures are still there, of course, but the functional connectivity, the communication loop that defines the network, it temporarily collapses.
And the subjective experience of this physical collapse is what the scientific literature calls ego dissolution.
Yes.
The OOTW journal text describes this vividly, based on clinical reports.
Mm.
It's a temporary loss of the normal boundary between the self and the rest of the world.
It is a profound phenomenological shift. I mean, humans normally navigate the world with that strict dichotomy. There is me in here, and there is the universe out there.
A very hard line.
Exactly. Ego dissolution blurs that line entirely.
Patients in these trials describe a feeling of merging with the room they're in, or feeling that the music playing in the headphones is actually originating from inside their own mind.
Yes.
They describe merging with nature or even with the entire cosmos. That hard, definitive boundary of being a separate, isolated individual sitting behind your eyes just softens and eventually vanishes entirely.
And we must note that subjectively, the emotional valence of this experience can swing wildly.
Oh, for sure.
For some, losing the concept of self is profoundly terrifying. It feels like madness or death, a total loss of control.
Because the ego is fighting to stay alive.
Right. But for others, it is described as the most meaningful, unifying, and peaceful experience of their entire life. Often, a single patient will experience both extremes within the exact same session.
The terror and the peace.
Yes. But what is truly remarkable from a scientific standpoint is that we can now measure this highly subjective state.
That part blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
How do you measure the loss of the soul or the ego on a spreadsheet?
Researchers developed and validated a psychometric tool called the Ego Dissolution Inventory, or the EDI.
The EDI.
It's a questionnaire that asks subjects to rate statements like, I experienced a dissolution of myself or ego, or I felt a sense of union with others.
And when they cross-referenced the patient's scores on the ego dissolution inventory with their actual fMRI brain scans, what did they find?
They found an incredibly tight correlation. The physical measurable drop in the coupling between the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex directly tracked the subjective intensity of the ego dissolution the person reported.
That is incredible.
The more the physical network came apart, the more the subjective ego dissolved.
Quiet the network, quiet the self.
Exactly.
That has to be one of the tightest, most direct brain-to-experience correspondences we have in all of consciousness science.
It really is.
But this naturally leads to a massive question.
Okay.
The ego shuts off. Subjectively, that sounds terrifying for a lot of people. Why on earth would inducing a state of chaotic disintegration actually have therapeutic value?
It's a fair question.
Right. Why does breaking the brain help cure someone of severe depression?
To understand the therapeutic mechanism, we have to look at a theoretical framework proposed by Carhart-Harris in 2014. It's known as the entropic brain hypothesis.
The entropic brain.
Yes. If we want to understand the utility of ego dissolution, we have to talk about entropy.
When I hear the word entropy, I immediately think of thermodynamics.
Mm.
You know, the second law of thermodynamics, the idea that a closed system moves from order to chaos over time.
Right, the physics definition.
Like an ice cube melting or a shattered glass. How does entropy apply to a conscious brain?
In this context, we lean closer to information theory entropy. It is a measure of disorder, randomness, or unpredictability in a system.
Okay, predictability.
Carhart-Harris applied this concept to human conscious states. Normal, everyday waking consciousness is characterized as a low entropy state.
Meaning it is highly predictable.
Yes. It is orderly, efficient, and heavily constrained. And it needs to be.
Right, to function.
You need low entropy to safely drive a car, do your taxes, or hold a normal conversation. The high-level networks, primarily the DMN, keep the lower-level sensory regions in check.
So what happens under psychedelics?
The psychedelic state is a high-entropy state. It is highly disordered, chaotic, flexible, and capable of generating a vastly richer repertoire of possible neural configurations.
So the drug induces chaos in the brain. But I'm still struggling to see why chaos is a good thing for a psychiatric patient.
It sounds counterproductive.
Yeah, if someone is depressed, wouldn't chaos just make them more unstable?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we need to look at a major refinement of this theory that came out in 2019. Carhart-Harris teamed up with Carl Friston,
who is one of the most highly cited neuroscientists in the world.
Yes, absolute legend in the field. They developed the REBS model.
REBS, what does that stand for?
Relaxed beliefs under psychedelics.
Relaxed beliefs under psychedelics. Okay.
And to understand REBS, we have to completely change how we think about perception. We have to view the brain as a prediction machine.
Let's spend some time on this, because the predictive brain model is critical to the whole article.
It really is the foundation.
The intuitive way we think about perception is bottom-up. We think our eyes take in light, our ears take in sound. That raw data travels up to the brain, and the brain passively builds a picture of reality from scratch every single millisecond.
That is the classical view. But biologically, that process would be far too slow and demand far too much computational power.
Right.
If you had to consciously process every single photon of light and every sound wave just to walk across a room, you would be paralyzed by data. So the brain uses a shortcut.
It guesses.
It actively predicts. The brain is constantly generating top-down expectations based on past experiences. Scientists call these expectations priors.
Priors.
The brain imposes these priors onto reality. It constructs a model of what it expects to see, hear, and feel, and it only pays attention to sensory information that contradicts the model, what we call prediction errors.
So if I walk into my living room at night, my brain already has a prior model of the room. It expects the couch to be there.
Right.
I don't need to visually process the entire couch from scratch. My brain just projects the expectation of the couch.
Precisely. And the default mode network sits at the very top of this predictive hierarchy. It holds the most abstract, deeply ingrained priors of all.
Like what kind of priors?
Your beliefs about yourself, your self-worth, and your relationship to the world. It uses these massive priors to filter and constrain all the incoming sensory and emotional data from the bottom up.
I was trying to think of a metaphor for this while reading the source, and it feels like having an incredibly overbearing editor.
An editor.
Yeah, an editor who is constantly reading the rough draft of your life story and mercilessly changing the words before you even get a chance to read them yourself.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The priors dictate the narrative.
And if you suffer from severe depression, that editor is ruthless, isn't it?
Absolutely ruthless.
The depressed brain is locked into a highly rigid, low-entropy state. The priors are punishing. And they are ironclad.
Yes, the system is too constrained.
If a depressed person has a neutral interaction with a coworker, the overbearing editor immediately rewrites the sensory data to fit the prior. They hate me. I am worthless.
Exactly.
If they look toward the future, the editor rewrites it as, nothing will ever get better. The brain becomes incapable of processing positive prediction errors.
The depressed brain is stuck in a deep pathological groove. It is over-constrained by negative priors. This is where the Rebus model explains the magic of psilocybin.
Okay, tie together for.
By chemically disrupting the 5-HT2A receptors and quieting the DMN, psilocybin actively relaxes the grip of these top-down priors.
The overbearing editor is forcefully sent on a coffee break.
The hierarchical constraints collapse. And suddenly, raw sensory and emotional information can flow up from the lower brain regions without being instantly crushed, filtered, or distorted by those rigid beliefs. The system shifts into high entropy. It becomes chaotic, yes, but more importantly, it becomes revisable.
Revisable. I love that word for this process.
It fits perfectly.
The narrative isn't just broken. It is opened up for editing. The patient can actually look at a memory or an emotion without the automatic assumption of guilt or worthlessness.
Exactly.
But you can't just leave a brain in a state of chaotic disintegration forever. If the drug only tore networks apart, it would just be a disruptive toxin.
Right, a poison, essentially.
The article emphasizes that while the DMN goes offline, the rest of the brain doesn't just power down. It actively rewires itself.
This brings us to the concept of global integration, which is the functional flip side of DMN disintegration.
Global integration. Let's get into that.
Under normal waking conditions, the human brain is highly modular.
Modular meaning it's divided into strict departments.
Think of it like a massive corporation. Different regions belong to their own separate networks or clubs. The visual cortex talks to itself. The motor cortex talks to itself. They do their specific jobs efficiently, and they rarely communicate directly with regions outside their silo.
They stay in their lane.
Yes. If they need to pass information across the brain, they route it through central hubs like the DMN.
But with the conductor gone and the hubs dismantled, the silos break down.
The corporate hierarchy collapses.
That's wild. So what happens then?
We see a dramatic flattening of the brain's communication landscape. Regions of the brain that have literally never spoken to each other directly before suddenly start crosstalking.
Wow.
The tidy, rigid, modular structure is replaced by a dense, chaotic, global web of new connections. The brain becomes wildly interconnected.
Which sounds like a fascinating party trick of the mind, honestly, resulting in things like synesthesia. You know, people seeing sounds or tasting colors because the visual and auditory departments are suddenly cross-wired.
Yes, that's exactly why that happens.
But the OTW journal text cites a major 2022 study in Nature Medicine by Dawes and colleagues that proves this global integration has massive clinical weight for treating depression.
It is a landmark study. The research team took fMRI data from two separate independent clinical trials for depression.
Okay.
They scanned patients before they took psilocybin and then scanned them again days or weeks after the drug had worn off to see how the brain had resettled.
And they found a physical signature for healing.
They found a clear, measurable pattern. The patients whose depression actually improved, the ones who reported feeling better on clinical rating scales, were the exact same patients who showed a lasting reduction in the brain's modularity and a significant increase in global network integration.
So their brains stayed more connected even after the drug was gone.
The whole brain had become more fluid and interconnected, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the magnitude of that physical change directly predicted the magnitude of their symptom relief.
Meaning?
The more the brain integrated, the better they felt.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second, though.
Sure.
If a patient takes a traditional daily antidepressant, like an SSRI, Lexapro, or Zoloft, and their depression gets better over a few months, don't we see that exact same global integration happen in their brain? Isn't this just what any brain recovering from depression looks like on an MRI?
It is a brilliant question, and it is exactly what Dawes and his team tested.
Oh, they did?
Yes. In one of the trials they analyzed, they had a control group taking escitalopram, a standard SSRI, for 6 weeks. They ran the exact same network analyses on the SSRI group, and the SSRIs did not produce this global integration signature.
Wait, so the SSRI patients who got better didn't show the same brain rewiring?
Not at all. Their brains remained highly modular.
Wow.
This implies that the therapeutic action of traditional antidepressants is fundamentally different from psychedelics.
How so?
SSRIs seem to work by blunting the emotional impact of stress, essentially putting a neurochemical floor under the patient so they don't fall as deep into despair.
They buffer it.
Exactly. But the therapeutic action of psilocybin lies in an active structural reintegration of a stuck network. It doesn't blunt the system, it shakes it up and reconnects it.
Okay, so we've covered the acute trip. The drug hits the receptor, the DMN is decoupled, the editor steps out, the ego devolves, and the brain starts cross-talking in a globally integrated way.
That's the sequence.
But an acute trip only lasts roughly 4 to 6 hours. The psilocin is metabolized and leaves the body. How does a six-hour chaotic experience cure severe depression for months at a time?
That's the real magic.
Right. To understand that, the article takes us beyond the trip itself, to the days and weeks that follow, the afterglow period.
This is where the narrative shifts from systems neuroscience looking at whole brain networks down to cellular biology.
Okay, going microscopic.
Psilocybin, along with other 5-HT2A activating compounds, belongs to a newly designated class of drugs called psychoplastogens.
Psychoplastogens, drugs that promote neuroplasticity.
Exactly. Neuroplasticity is the brain's physical ability to rewire itself, to grow new physical connections, and to adapt to new information.
Which we used to think adult brains couldn't really do.
For a long time, we thought the adult brain was relatively fixed. We now know it can change, but it usually takes intense, prolonged effort, like years of therapy or learning a new language.
But psychoplastogens speed that up.
Psychoplastogens seem to trigger this plasticity rapidly and robustly.
The article cites a crucial 2021 study from the journal Neuron by a researcher named Shao and colleagues. And this study gets down to the microscopic level. They weren't using fMRI, they were using two-photon microscopy to look at the actual neurons of living mice.
The visual evidence from this study is stunning. They found that a single dose of psilocybin drives the physical growth of new dendritic spines in the frontal cortex within 24 hours.
Let's define dendritic spines for the listener, because growing spines in your brain sounds a little alarming.
Yeah, let's clarify that. A neuron looks a bit like a tree. It has a central cell body, and it has branches reaching out called dendrites.
Okay, the branches.
Dendritic spines are tiny little protrusions that grow off those branches. They are the physical connection points, the synapses, where one neuron receives a signal from another.
They're the bridges.
They are the literal physical infrastructure of learning and memory. When you learn a new habit or reframe a traumatic memory, your brain is physically growing and strengthening dendritic spines.
And the researchers could literally see these new spines sprouting on the dendrites just a day after the psilocybin dose.
Yes, and this rapid structural growth is driven by a massive intracellular cascade triggered by the 5-HT2A receptor, leading to the release of BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Which I've heard described as miracle grow for the brain.
It essentially is. BDNF signals the brain to survive, grow, and build new pathways. And crucially, in the Shao study, they found that roughly 10% of these newly generated microscopic connections persisted for a month after that single dose.
1 month.
The structural change was highly durable.
I want to synthesize everything we've talked about so far, using a metaphor from Robin Carhart-Harris that the text highlights, because it brings the systems neuroscience and the cellular biology together perfectly. The metaphor is a snow globe.
It is perhaps the most elegant way to visualize the entire process.
Imagine the depressed brain as a snow globe. Over years of trauma, genetic predisposition, or chronic stress, deep grooves have been carved into the snow at the bottom of the globe.
Deep, rigid tracks.
These grooves represent the rigid top-down priors we talked about earlier, the negative thought loops. When a thought or an emotion falls into the globe, it has nowhere else to go.
Right.
It inevitably slides down those exact same pessimistic, self-defeating pathways every single time.
In thermodynamic terms, the brain is trapped in a deep local minimum, a low entropy, highly rigid state. It takes too much energy for the thought to jump out of the deep groove and find a new path.
So what does this all mean when we introduce the drug? Let's walk through the narrative flow.
Let's do it.
First, the psilocin hits the 5-HT2A receptors on the pyramidal neurons. Second, the default mode network, the conductor, is quieted and uncoupled.
Right.
Third, those deep grooves, the rigid priors, relax their grip. The ego dissolves. The brain becomes chaotic, highly interconnected, and globally integrated.
This is the shaking of the snow globe.
Exactly. The intense energy of the psychedelic state acts as the shaking. The frozen, rigid patterns are disrupted, and the snow is lifted up, swirling chaotically in the water. The deep grooves are temporarily erased.
But eventually the drug wears off, the chaotic trip ends, the snow has to settle back down.
But here is the critical part. Because of that massive surge in BDNF and cellular neuroplasticity, the literal growth of new dendritic spines while the globe was shaken, The brain does not have to settle back into the exact same frozen grooves it was in before.
It's a fresh slate.
The neural landscape is malleable.
The text notes that the default mode network does eventually come back online. As the psilocin clears the receptors over the next 12 to 24 hours, the MPFC and the PCC synchronize again.
The pendulum clocks sync back up.
The network reintegrates. Your ego comes back. You remember your name. You remember your history. You return to baseline reality.
But the mind that reassembles itself around that network is structurally different. The snow has settled into a new, flatter landscape.
Yes.
The patient has a window of opportunity, days or weeks, of heightened plasticity, where they can form new, healthier thought patterns before the snow freezes solid again.
And this beautiful, intricate neuroscientific story from receptors to networks to snow globes wouldn't mean much if it didn't translate to real, measurable human healing.
Right, if it was just theory.
But the clinical evidence backing this up is becoming undeniable. The OOTW Journal article lays out a timeline of heavy-hitting clinical trials that have forced the psychiatric establishment to really pay attention.
Let's walk through that clinical data. It really kicks into high gear around 2021 with a landmark study out of Johns Hopkins University.
The Hopkins trial was a rigorous, randomized study looking at major depressive disorder. They provided patients with two doses of psilocybin paired with extensive psychotherapy.
And the results?
The results were staggering. They observed large, rapid, and clinically significant reductions in depression scores.
Oh, rapid.
Unlike traditional drugs that take weeks to build up in the system, these improvements were often seen within a day of the dosing session, and they proved to be durable, lasting for months in a majority of the participants.
Wow. Then, in that same year, you have the Imperial College London trial, which was published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine.
A huge milestone.
This wasn't just testing if psilocybin worked against a placebo. This was a head-to-head fight against the current standard of care.
They pitted psilocybin directly against a escitalopram, a widely prescribed daily SSRI. It was a very bold study design.
And who won?
The results showed that psilocybin was at least as effective as the daily antidepressant. In fact, on several secondary measures of well-being, emotional connection, and remission rates, psilocybin showed faster and broader improvements.
So it wasn't just matching it.
No, it wasn't just matching the standard of care. It was suggesting a more holistic form of recovery.
But the real turning point, the data that pushes this from promising academic research toward mainstream FDA-approved medicine, comes from a company called Compass Pathways and their proprietary synthetic psilocybin formulation known as COMP360.
Right. This is where we move into the massive multi-center trials required for regulatory approval. Compass ran a phase 2B trial with 233 patients.
And these weren't just mildly depressed individuals, were they?
No, these were patients suffering from treatment-resistant depression.
Meaning they had already tried multiple traditional antidepressants and nothing had worked. Their snow globes were frozen solid.
Exactly. In this phase 2B trial, they found that a single high dose of 25 milligrams of synthetic psilocybin significantly outperformed a 1 milligram control dose in reducing depression severity.
And the timeline in the article takes us right up to the massive news from 2025 and 2026. Compass reported the results of their phase 3 trials.
The big ones.
For the listener who might not know, phase 3 trials are the final, massive, definitive hurdles a drug must clear to prove it is safe and effective before the FDA will approve it for public use.
The article confirms that both of their phase 3 trials successfully hit their primary endpoint.
That's huge.
The statistical significance was incredibly strong, with a p-value of less than 0.001. That indicates a highly reliable, clinically meaningful reduction in treatment-resistant depression scores, with the therapeutic effects showing up almost immediately and holding steady for weeks.
Based on this 2025 and 2026 data, they are expected to file a new drug application, an NDA, with the FDA in late 2026. We are not talking about the distant future anymore.
No, we are not.
This is happening right now. We are on the precipice of a paradigm shift in psychiatry.
This raises an important question, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because as clear, elegant, and hopeful as this story is, the OTW Journal article is fiercely disciplined about pointing out the caveats.
The reality check.
Exactly. As experts analyzing this data, we have to be brutally honest about the limits of what we know and the dangers of media hype.
Absolutely. The science is beautiful, but we cannot fall into the trap of oversimplifying it or treating this molecule as a magic bullet. What is the first major caveat we need to address?
First, we have to remember a foundational rule of science. Correlation is not causation.
Right.
We see the changes in the default mode network tracking very closely with the subjective experience of ego dissolution. But we must acknowledge that psilocybin acts broadly across the entire cortex.
It isn't a laser beam that only targets the DMN.
No, it's not. Other major brain networks are changing simultaneously. The visual system, the salience network, the thalamus. The DMN is clearly a lead character in this story, but it is definitely not the only actor on the stage.
We're just focusing on the DMN because it aligns so well with our psychological concepts of the ego.
Right.
Which brings up the second caveat.
Yeah.
We have to reiterate the limit of the metaphor itself.
Yes. DMN equals ego is a highly useful way to visualize the process, but we are mapping highly subjective ancient philosophical concepts onto biological tissue.
It's an imperfect translation.
The ego is a concept originally popularized by Freud. It isn't a biological organ you can put on a scale. There is a lot of nuance lost when we try to cleanly map psychology onto neuroanatomy.
And what about the brain imaging itself? Because I know fMRI studies have faced a lot of criticism in the past for being, well, kind of statistically flimsy.
That is a very valid point from a strictly scientific perspective. Historically, human fMRI studies have relied on very small sample sizes, sometimes just 15 or 20 people, because scanning is incredibly expensive.
Right. Costs thousands of dollars an hour.
Exactly. We have learned hard lessons in neuroscience about overreading data from small groups or finding false positives in the statistical noise. The field is maturing rapidly, and the trials are getting much larger, like those massive Phase 3 COMPASS trials. But scientific humility is always required when interpreting brain scans.
Which brings us to the most critical caveat of all, and this is a safety warning the article makes forcefully, and we want to echo it completely here. This entire discussion is absolutely not a recommendation for unsupervised use.
Psilocybin is a potent, powerful molecule. It is not a casual supplement, and it is not risk-free.
The physiological impacts alone are real. It temporarily raises blood pressure and heart rate. But the psychological risks are even more prominent.
Much more prominent, yes.
Subjectively, stripping away the ego and relaxing all your defensive priors can trigger intense fear, panic, and deep confusion. And the article specifically notes that it is actively dangerous for individuals with a personal or family history of psychotic disorders, like schizophrenia.
Context is absolutely everything here. The concept of set and setting, the mindset of the user, and the physical environment they are in is paramount.
Right.
A quiet default mode network is not automatically a healing default mode network. If you dissolve someone's ego in a chaotic, unsafe, or unsupported environment, you aren't curing their depression. You are highly likely to traumatize them.
That's like shaking the snow globe and dropping it on the floor.
Exactly. The breathtaking clinical results we just talked about, the Hopkins trial, the Imperial trial, the COMPASS Phase 3 data, those did not happen in a vacuum.
They happened in highly controlled, supervised clinical environments.
Yes. Patients underwent weeks of preparatory therapy before taking the drug. They wore eye shades and listened to curated music during the experience while two trained therapists sat beside them, and they underwent integration therapy in the weeks afterward to make sense of the chaotic insights.
The drug is merely the master key that opens the biological door to plasticity. It melts the snow.
That's all it does.
But the therapy, the psychological support, and the safe setting are what actively guide the brain to reassemble into a healthier shape. It is the human context that turns a chaotic chemical event into a profoundly therapeutic one.
It is a synergy of pharmacology and psychology. Neither works fully without the other in this context.
So to bring this massive journey all together for you, the listener, we have traced a stunningly clean scientific thread today.
We really have.
We started with one specific biological lock, the 5-HT2A receptor on a pyramidal neuron. We watched the psilocin molecule turn that key, which led to the quieting and uncoupling of the massive default mode network.
The unseating of the conductor.
We saw how that physical decoupling perfectly translates to the subjective experience of the ego dissolving, of the inner narrator finally going silent.
Right.
We explored how the brain responds by breaking down its rigid silos, integrating globally, and opening a profound window of cellular neuroplasticity, allowing a stuck, depressed mind to shake the snow globe and resettle into a new, healthier pattern. It's an incredibly elegant mechanism.
It really is one of the most remarkable stories the human brain has ever told us about itself. We're looking at the actual physical machinery of the self going completely transparent and then having the privilege of watching it rebuild itself anew.
Which leaves us with a final thought that I want you, the listener, to carry with you as you go about your day.
Let's hear it.
We started by talking about that voice in your head. the relentless narrator building the story of who you are, what you're capable of, and what your past means. The science we've unpacked today shows us that this you, your ego, your identity is, on a fundamental structural level, largely maintained by a specific network of neurons firing together.
It is an ongoing biological habit.
But if a single molecule derived from a mushroom can temporarily dismantle the neural network responsible for yourself, then who or what are you when that network is completely offline?
A great question.
If the ego is just a habit of neural firing, a temporary pattern carved into a snow globe, what new habits will you choose to build when your snow globe finally settles?
Thank you for taking this step dive with us today.
Keep questioning the narrative, especially the one inside your own head. See you next time.